Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. National Farmers Market Week isn't exactly a hallmark holiday, but the growing number of markets around the country, especially in so-called food deserts, is a testament enough to the importance of fresh, local food and a healthy diet. Today we're talking about how large cities like Columbus have embraced farmers markets as one component in a larger community-based approach to health. The city of Columbus has sponsored three farmers markets this year. The second one is going on at the Columbus Public Health Department's front yard on Parsons Avenue right now. The market runs till 1. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link there for you with information that you need to get there. Joining us later on this hour will be two OSU researchers in the OSU College of Public Health to share their insights on the significance of farmers markets, how they work to promote healthy diets, and what else is needed to complete the equation. Right now, we welcome Dr. Mashika Lamail-Williams. She's the Assistant Health Commissioner and Medical Director for the Columbus Public Health Department. Glad you could join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Today's market at the City Health Department is part of a larger plan for health. When did the city decide this was necessary? When did this get on your radar?
Well, we've been hosting the farmers market on our grounds for the last 6 years, and it's really been during that same time period that the city felt like we should support even more farmers markets throughout the larger community of Columbus. So they've been doing that. We've been doing that. We've been working with our city leaders and community leaders to help offer smaller markets throughout different neighborhoods. Some are all season long while farmers markets are in existence. Our markets are only held for 3 consecutive weeks, and it's geared towards the larger community on the Near East Side, Old Town East area, but also towards our WIC clients, Franklin County wide.
When you're looking for a farmer's market, what are you looking for in a neighborhood? What are you shooting for? What's the basics?
The basics in terms of what the market should offer?
Yes.
Well, we want them to have a variety of fresh fruits and vegetables. We know that that's a hallmark of any stable diet, is to have fresh fruits and vegetables, not canned, preferably not frozen. So we're looking for farmers who can come and provide that at the market. And we're also looking at neighborhoods that might not have easy access to a full-scale grocery store where they can have choices for fruits and vegetables. So we're targeting neighborhoods that might not have full-service grocery stores nearby.
It's been going on for 6 years. At first, was it difficult to attract vendors to your farmers markets?
You know, every year the market has grown in terms of the number of farmers we have as well as the number of participants who come and shop. Last year we had over 11,000 visitors come to our campus in the 3 consecutive markets, and we had about 10 to 12 farmers. This year we have our largest farmer participation ever at 15 farmers. So we've been very pleased with that, and we'll see what our final numbers are. But last week we had a good turnout, and we were very pleased. So we've seen it grow every year as we've opened it up to the larger community and as more of our WIC clients come out and support the market. There's been a larger message not only here in Franklin County but really nationally to encourage individuals to lead a healthy lifestyle by eating more fresh fruits and vegetables.
How do you get the word out to folks that this is available to them?
Well, one is to our WIC clients. We post signs in our WIC clinics. We have 10 WIC clinics throughout Franklin County, and we serve over 38,000 WIC clients.
And women, infants, and children.
Yes. And then, so that's one avenue we use. And then the larger community. So we use the media, social media. We use small community organizations to get the message out, posting signs in different neighborhoods and different community centers to inform people that this is available and they should come out and take part in this farmers market.
Even still, just to get there, still, for a lot of people, probably is a burden, and they work.
Well, for the working individuals that work, you know, traditional hours of 8 to 5, it is hard. But for those who live in the neighborhood and might have untraditional hours or might be off for the day or can come by at their lunchtime, it works for them in the community. And obviously for our senior citizens who are retired, and it works for them. And we've been fortunate over the last few years to have some senior coupons available as well at our farmers market.
We also have with us right now Howard Yoder of Yoder Farms. He's the owner of Yoder Farms. Howard, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Howard, how long have you been working with the city in their farmers market?
Well, I've been coming to this market, the Columbus Public Health Market, since its inception, I believe, 6 years ago, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I've been going to other farmers markets around the city for probably about 10 years.
What inspired you to get involved in the city's farmers market?
Well, I would say there's three things that I think of offhand. A number of years ago, our farm was strictly devoted to corn and soybean production, and I decided that I wanted to be involved with food production for direct human consumption. And I began to make some small steps in that direction. So as a result of that, the second reason was kind of a logical step, was that people seem to enjoy face-to-face encounters with the people who are growing their food. And so I decided that that would be something that I would enjoy. And I do, in fact, enjoy the people contact in the farmers market setting. And thirdly, I guess I would say in purely economic terms, it's a great opportunity to market produce from the farm, to be in these market venues around Columbus.
Dr. Lamille Williams, what is the benefit to having people buy their food from the farmer face-to-face?
Well, they're getting fresh fruits and vegetables. They're getting straight from the farm, and they get to take them home and make them in their own kitchen and serve them at their own dinner table. We know they're more nutritious. We know that they provide a healthier meal to not only the mother who is caring for maybe an infant, but also the young growing children and anyone. We also know that in our world right now, there is an increase of overweight and obesity, and we know there's an increase of chronic illnesses like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. So eating fresh fruits and vegetables is one way of many to help control some of those health issues that we're dealing with.
Do the folks that shop at your farmers markets, do they enjoy that face-to-face contact? Because it can be a little intimidating, too. Sometimes I'm a little shy around the farmers. No offense, Howard, but you know, you want to ask them questions or something, but you don't quite know how.
Yeah.
And
you know, when I've gone to our markets, and I go every week, and I stroll around and just see what's going on. First of all, it's a wonderful setting. I mean, you're amazed at the diversity that we have here in our community, and we really see it firsthand at our markets. But the farmers, and Howard is one example of many. They are very friendly, and I don't know if it's because of the clientele and the energy at the market, but they're more than willing to answer questions and be proactive and explain to individuals, this is what this is, this is how you could prepare it, this is what it tastes like. They have samples there of some of the fresh fruit. So I don't find our market very intimidating. It's crowded, but I think the farmers as well as the public health volunteers that are there, not only from the College of Public Health, but also from our health department and all throughout the city, are very friendly and involved to engage the clients to let them know what this is and the best way to prepare it.
We're talking about urban farmer markets, and in particular, the farmer's market started by Columbus Public Health Department. Joining me right now, Dr. Mashika Lamille Williams, and also Howard Yoder of Yoder Farms. Howard, are the customers at the city's farmer's market the same as anywhere?
I would say so, for the most part. I find them to be concerned about their public, about their health. I would say they're active and want good nutrition to be part of the kind of lifestyle they live for the most part. That's what I would say about the people who come to this market. These markets around Columbus, pretty much like society in general, I would say, yes.
Mm-hmm. What have you learned over the last 6 years, 6 seasons, about how to operate the market and what people need to make it work for them?
We've learned a lot of different things. I mean, the biggest thing is from a logistics standpoint at our facility is how do we get people in and out so that we can serve as many clients as possible. But in terms of for the clients themselves, we've learned to broaden our market to try to open it up to as many individuals as possible and not just limit it to our WIC clients. So we've done a lot of different things in terms of marketing, and that way we have in years past, and unfortunately this year we don't, but we have had demonstrations of how to prepare the food there, and that has been helpful. And we also give out a lot of information, pamphlets to share for people to take home with them of how to prepare the information. As I mentioned earlier, we have a very diverse clientele, so we have on hand translators for both Spanish, Somali, and that has helped us a lot attract a more diverse group to come to our market.
What about the WIC and food stamps? That started right off the bat, or was that something you introduced?
Now, the history of the market is really that we started it 6 years ago to increase our WIC vouchers being turned in. We were giving out farmers market vouchers to our WIC clients in our clinics, and we were learning that our clients weren't using them. They weren't turning them in, and they weren't using them. So we felt like they didn't have access. They didn't know where to go to find a farmers market. They didn't feel comfortable going to the various farmers markets, or it was too far for them to travel. So we said we should have a market right here on our grounds. They know how to get here. It's easily accessible. We have bus access, and it's a place that they're familiar with. And we started doing that 6 years ago, and we found that our voucher turn-in rate has doubled and tripled since that time because people come to the market, they get their voucher for the market, and they go straight out and shop right there. It's a one-stop deal for them.
Howard Yoder, is it a hassle to deal with food stamps and the WIC coupons, or is it just business as usual?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that question. Could you repeat that?
Is it difficult to deal with the WIC coupons and the food stamps and that sort of thing, or is it just the same as cash and check?
It's really quite simple. We don't have a lot of difficulties with this whole process. They are used like cash, and really there's not a serious complication. We simply send them in, and the cash is deposited, or the check is deposited in our electronically in our accounts. So as far as handling them at the farmers markets, we really have very few problems with that.
Dr. Lamail-Williams, what about other farmers markets? How typical is it for them to take WIC coupons and food stamps?
Many of our farmers markets around town do accept WIC vouchers as well as food stamps. And that's been increasing over the last few years, and we're very proud to be partners with that to encourage more markets to accept the vouchers. So that's something that's not just available at Columbus Public Health, but other markets around town as well.
Okay, so what are the remaining challenges then? What would you like to see change?
Wow, that's a big question, Ann.
You have 20 seconds.
Well, you know, we still have issues. I mean, farmers markets are usually just an abbreviated period of time, spring, summer, and fall. So there's still the winter months where individuals don't have easy access to fresh fruits and vegetables if they're dependent on the farmers markets for that. And so most people during those months are dependent on their grocery store, their full-scale grocery store. And we know from research we've done that not everyone in our community has access to full-service grocery stores. We also know that farmers markets aren't the only answer. So we've been doing other things, and we've been supporting other efforts. We have our Institute of Active Living that's been supporting community gardens. We've been encouraging individuals to start their own community garden right there in their neighborhood to grow their own fresh fruits and vegetables that they can use. People can grow gardens at their home. We've also been encouraging healthy eating through our Healthy Children, Healthy Weights program, which is a program where we go out to area daycares and we teach the instructors as well as the students, the young kids, what's healthy, what tastes good, and we give them nutritious treats that they really like carrot sticks made into funny little pieces. And we know that if we start early, the earlier we train young kids of what is healthy, the more success we're going to have in really making an impact on their health behavior. So food is just one aspect of it. We still need to be active. We all need to have an active lifestyle. And I think our mayor has been doing a great job of promoting bicycling and healthy activity. There was a website launch recently about that, Get Active Columbus, so that we're very proud of that as well. So the farmers markets are just one aspect, and there's so many more aspects of healthy living that we're working on and devoted to improving in our community.
Okay, we have to take a break. I want to say thanks to Howard Yoder of Yoder Farms. Thanks for joining us today, Howard.
Nice to be here.
And when we return, Nancy Hood and John Crawford of the OSU College of Public Health. Actually, it's John. His nickname's Mac. And that's what we'll be calling him when we return on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, 1 year after the multi-billion dollar bailout, Detroit is buzzing over profits, new jobs, and electric cars. We'll look under the hood and check the vitals of America's auto industry. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU-820 NPR News. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:21. Clouds today with some sunshine expected later this afternoon, a high of 88 degrees. There is a 30% chance of rain off and on throughout the day. Clear skies tonight, a low of 65, and a nice day for Friday, sunshine and cooler with a high of 82. And looking ahead to Saturday, sunny and a high of 84. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about farmers markets and why we need them in our neighborhoods. We'll be talking in a few minutes with Nancy Hood. She is a doctoral candidate in the OSU College of Public Health. She is manager in the OSU College of Public Health Division of Health Behavior and Health Promotion. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And also Mac Crawford. He is assistant professor of clinical public health in OSU's College of Public Health. Welcome to the show, Mac.
Thanks for having me.
And if you would like to join our conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. I know that we build this show as a live remote at the farmers market at the city public health department on Parsons Avenue, but we had a technical glitch and we weren't able to do it. No one's more disappointed than I, but it's still going on. It's going on until 1 o'clock today. So if you want to make it out there, do so. You can go to WOSU.org/allsides and we'll have a link there for you, to give you more information and directions and that sort of thing. Nancy Hood, what do we know about what people need to consume? As far as fruits and vegetables, it seems sort of simple, but I guess compared to what they actually do consume.
Yes. Well, we know from the national recommendations that people should be getting, an average person should get about 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And that's about 4.5 cups. And that's for somebody who consumes about 2,000 calories. And in contrast to that, we know from surveillance studies that only about a quarter of adults in the U.S. actually consume even 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. So there's a pretty big discrepancy between the recommendation and what's actually happening.
And why is that?
Well, when we think about people's health behaviors from a public health perspective, we like to think about multiple levels of influence. So you have the individual at the center, and certainly factors like individual choice and preferences and skills and attitudes are going to affect what they eat. But then you also have their social influences and what they learned by watching their mothers or families growing up, and you have social norms. And then at the next level of influence, you have what's available in their grocery stores. And then at the next level of influence, you have policies. And so really the answer to the question of why we have that discrepancy involves all of those factors.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the show, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So for that 25% or so that's doing it right, who are they and what do they know? I mean, what is it about their lifestyle and their life that sets them apart?
Well, we know that there's disparities in who's doing it right and who's not able to meet the recommendations. For example, in Franklin County, there was a community health risk assessment that was done in 2005, and adults that had less than a high school diploma, only 13% of them reported getting at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And that was compared to 28% of college graduates. Also, income is a factor. The lowest income adults, only 16% report getting 5 servings compared to 29% for the highest income group. So education and income are certainly a piece of the puzzle.
At least they're correlations, because people who don't have a lot of money, it's not necessarily that they don't want to spend it on fruits and vegetables.
Exactly. There was actually a study done a couple years ago in California that looked at how much it would cost for lower-income households to meet the recommendations of 9 servings. And households would have to spend somewhere between 40 and 70% of their food budget on fruits and vegetables. So, you know, that's a big barrier for sure.
In our society today.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention that OSU is a sponsor and an underwriter, I'm not sure how you put it, of the Columbus Public Health Farmers Market.
I think we're a partner.
Partner, okay.
Yeah, so.
Is that something that the OSU does a lot? Are there other programs like that you're involved in?
Yes, the College of Public Health at OSU has several initiatives now to address the issue of overweight and obesity and helping people eat better. In fact, the college just got a 5-year grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for a prevention research center, and the focus of that center is to help make prevention research more usable and relevant for real people in real communities. And their core research project is going to be focusing on helping preschool children and parents of preschool children in the south side of Columbus develop healthful eating habits and be physically active early in life. So just like Dr. Williams was saying, it's important to establish those behaviors early in life. So that's another project that the college is working on. And we've also done quite a bit with a corner store initiative. I don't know if you...
Tell us about that.
Sure. This was a partnership with the United Way of Central Ohio. They're working on developing a corner store initiative to help increase access to fruits and vegetables in corner stores, which is where a lot of folks who live in these areas referred to earlier as food deserts are going to be doing some of their shopping. And a clinical associate professor at our college, Dr. Randy Love, had her students in a class this summer do an assessment of 52 corner stores in 5 neighborhoods in Columbus. And they found that, in fact, there is not a lot of access to fruits and vegetables there. And so the results of that assessment are going to be used by the United Way of Central Ohio to develop a pilot intervention and then hopefully bring it to scale.
Why can't there be more fresh fruits and vegetables at the corner stores? What's the problem? There's not the economies of scale. There's not enough demand. They don't have the place to store them and keep them fresh.
All of the above.
Okay.
You got it. You don't need us, Ann.
Okay. Blah, blah, blah. Away I go. We have an email or a message from Nora on Facebook. I've always understood that frozen vegetables are as nutritious as fresh, and they are certainly easier to keep. Why is your guest so against frozen vegetables? Is anybody against frozen vegetables?
No, I didn't say that I was against them, and I'm sorry she misunderstood me. Frozen vegetables can be just as good as fresh, but if you have fresh fruits and fresh vegetables, those are more advantageous to your health than frozen. So during those seasons when you have access to them, we encourage you to take advantage of that.
What about the idea of variety in your diet, that knowing that there's different kinds of peppers, knowing that there's different kinds of cucumbers? That's what I've learned from going to farmers markets. Is, you know, the heirloom tomatoes are a really big deal right now, but really I first started seeing them years ago in farmers markets. What about that, the variety? How does that help?
Well, certainly the recommendations are that you get a range of types of fruits and vegetables, and one way you can think of that is color. In terms of the different varieties of tomatoes and cucumbers specifically, I think that adds to probably flavor more than anything, which mm-hmm. can help develop preferences for fruits and vegetables. If they taste better, people are going to prefer them and like them better. And we also know from research that kids can start developing preferences at a young age, and it's important to have repeated exposures. And so if you have all those different flavors and all those different colors, then that's going to help with preferences as well.
But you're competing with repeated exposures to burger doodles out there in the world. I mean, daily, you know, repeated exposures. How do you compete with, as I like to call them, burger doodles out there?
I don't know what a burger doodle is.
It's a fast food restaurant.
That's definitely a challenge, especially when you get to the inner city communities where those burger doodle locations are much more accessible than a full service grocery store where they can have access to a variety of different foods, flavors, and colors. So that is something we struggle with daily, and that's why it takes starting at a young age to expose them to the fresh the fresh foods, the flavors, the colors, the taste, and the reason why that's better for them than the burger doodles, as well as working with the parents and making those fresh foods accessible and affordable.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You talked about, Nancy, about broad community-based approach to health, not just individual choices. What do you mean by that? What's the difference?
Well, we think about creating an environment where it's easier and possible for people to make healthy choices. So, for example, there was a study that was done in New Orleans that found that for every additional meter of shelf space for fruits and vegetables in small food stores, residents who lived near those food stores had about a third more servings of fruits and vegetables a day. So that's one example of where you're looking at the environmental influences that create the environment where people either can or can't make healthier choices.
We have an email from Robert. He writes, how can your movement shake the notion that eating good equals eating expensive equals eating uppity? Interesting. Anyone want to take a stab at that?
Well, I think we all have to think back to, years ago and how our ancestors lived. They lived from produce and food from the farm. And so I think, I look at it, that's the foundation. These new approaches to dining out, the burger doodles, that's new for us. And with that, we've seen an increase of overweight, obesity. With that, we've seen an increase of chronic disease. So I don't compare eating healthy to being uppity or being expensive. I look at it as going back to basics and going back to where we all started, which was eating things that we were prepared or grown on our property and made in our own homes.
Once again, there's the assumption often that if you don't have a lot of money, you don't want to eat healthfully. And it really has a lot more to do, Nancy, with access. Is access just a matter of not living near a big grocery store? Because I drive to the grocery store.
Driving is one option. A lot of times when we're talking about lower income communities where you have the greatest disparities in fruit and vegetable intake, driving is not always an option for them. And if you have to take a couple different bus transfers to get there and have a couple kids in tow, it can be quite an ordeal to get to a larger grocery store that has a better selection of fruits and vegetables and may have better prices as well.
And maybe if you get off work at 1 o'clock in the morning, there's nothing open.
Right.
Near you. All righty, we have a call right now. If you want to call us, 614-292-8513. And Dan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question for your guest about the other advantages to having numerous farmers markets around the town. For instance, might it help reduce the number of food miles and help us in our food security situation?
Well, that's a perfect opportunity to re-welcome Matt Crawford. He's the Assistant Professor of Clinical Public Health in OSU College of Public Health, and this is kind of his deal. So, Mac?
Well, hi, Dan.
Hi.
I know Dan.
Hi, Dan.
And that's a good question. You know, this is kind of fitting in, as Ann mentioned, into the bigger picture. One word that's thrown around a lot, but not a lot of people understand, is sustainability. And, the simplest definition of that is the capacity to endure. Another way to think about it is ordering our lives and doing things in a way that doesn't impinge on the ability of future generations to live and thrive. I think by reducing the number of miles involved in bringing food to the market and, getting it to people, you reduce energy consumption. And, our society has been gorging itself on energy for, you know, decades. So I think, you know, this community garden, community markets can all reduce that.
But the other folks will say, yes, but these big farms produce a lot of food that go to a lot of people that just don't have access to community gardens or local gardens. They feed the world. And if we don't continue to maintain a market for that, a demand for that, then they can't survive.
Well, you know, Mr. Yoder was a good example of someone who was producing corn and soybeans in large amounts. And that, you know, that goes to make things like cornmeal and high fructose corn syrup, soybean oil, and, you know, soybeans for use in all kinds of products. There's no question that there will continue to be markets for that. You know, that these kinds of societal changes that I'd like to see, relocalization of our economies, aren't going to happen overnight. But Mr. Yoder made a conscious decision to start bringing food directly to people. So much of the corn and soybean that's produced is used indirectly. You know, it's used to make animal feed, for example. So, you know, I recognize that. But these are you know, this is a big ship.
They're not mutually exclusive, though.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Dan, did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we'll talk a little bit more with Matt Crawford about that idea of sustainability and something he calls the resilience puzzle. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Capital City Radio is the new HD radio service from WOSU. Get an eclectic blend of blues, rock, world, folk, and alternative country on Capital City Radio, which means an opportunity for great musical discoveries 24/7. Keep up with the local music and concert scene with shows like Groundswell Columbus and Capital Noise. Listen to Capital City Radio on WOSU HD3 89.7 FM or online at capitalcityradio.org.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of the program will be here, and we'll hear how community gardens increase access to local food, improve the health of the community, and stock food pantries while bringing neighbors together. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today mixing with a little bit of sunshine, and a high of 88 degrees. There's still a 30% chance of rain throughout the day, and it's going to be a little humid. For tonight, partly cloudy skies, a low of 65. Looking at Friday, sunshine and a high of 82, a nice day for Friday and a little cooler. And looking ahead to Saturday, sunny skies and a high of 84. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820. NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us in the studio, Mashika LaMail-Williams. She is with the Columbus Public Health Department. Also, Nancy Hood with the OSU College of Public Health. And now joining us at the end of the last segment, John Mack Crawford. Matt Crawford to us. He is a public health assistant professor in the OSU. Assistant professor in the OSU College of Public Health. You were talking about really resilience, community resilience, and the idea that if we continue to depend on these sources of food that are far away and tough to get at without spending a lot of oil, we could fall flat on our face eventually.
Yeah, well, think about it this way. We have a just-in-time society, right? So at Walmart or other big stores, they keep track of their inventory with radio frequency ID technology, you know, barcodes and things. So when they start running low on an item, it goes through a computer, it says, send us more of this. Truck gets loaded up, comes to Walmart, everybody's happy. So what happens if, as happened in the 1970s, through maybe war with Iran, which a lot of people are talking about these days. Let's say the Gulf of Hormuz gets pinched and Iran, and there's difficulty getting oil out of those areas. Or let's say we have trouble with Venezuela. They supply us with a lot of oil.
Right.
Mexico is starting to decline in their oil production. And this is a phenomenon that we will see more of in the next 20 years. Traditionally large oil producers either holding on to their oil for their own populations or just being unable to keep up with the demand. If that happens and we start having disruptions in supply and difficulty getting these big trucks fueled, that just-in-time system breaks down. A community that has more local agriculture and more people with their own gardens and with community gardens and with community-supported agriculture, where a farmer contracts with people in the community to, you know, bring them food every week, the more a community is set up like that, the more resilient it is, the more it's able to absorb a shock to the system. That's what a resilience is, being able to bend and take that shock. So, you know, that's the big point about resilience is that by these local businesses and local agriculture can help us in that event.
Okay, so local businesses, so food's one aspect of it. What are some other examples of how we can be more resilient?
Well, you can think about transportation. So in the area in Central Ohio, there are dozens of groups springing up, sustainability groups. There's Sustainable Clintonville, Sustainable Worthington, Pickerington. There's one in Delaware now. There are also groups dedicated to biking, to mass transit. So, you know, there are groups dedicated to improving our bus service. There are people trying to get rail back up in gear. The 3C corridor is a big topic these days. I mentioned the community-supported agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are all these groups out there that have been working independently. And there's now a movement that's worldwide. There are over 200 transition towns and transition communities in the world. And there are dozens that have sprung up in the U.S., including in Colorado. Los Angeles has a transition movement. The idea is to improve community resilience. And the transition part is we really need to think about transitioning off of fossil fuels. And this is sort of like saying this is analogous to the big agriculture issue. And there are people that rely on big agriculture for their livelihoods. There are also people that rely on fossil fuels for their livelihoods. We've seen that in the Gulf with the shutdown. The moratorium on drilling mm-hmm. has affected people that work on those rigs. There's no question. There are coal miners who will be affected by this transition. So we have to find ways of organizing our society, producing the things that people need in a way that can be sustained. That's, you know, if we continue to rely on fossil fuels, you know, we'll do nothing but increase the carbon output. I haven't mentioned climate change, but that's another issue. And energy security, these are kind of twin issues. Another area is water, so water availability. I highly recommend anybody who can take a tour of a wastewater treatment facility and a drinking water treatment facility. You'll be amazed. The infrastructure is huge. It's an amazing process. Takes a lot of know-how, a lot of engineering to make it happen.
And it's absolutely necessary.
Yes, yes. If these water systems were to break down, it wouldn't take long before people would be getting desperate.
Tell us about, when you say transition communities, you're not talking about Sustainable Worthington, are you?
I'm talking about, in Central Ohio, we call ourselves Transition Central Ohio, and we are working to become a hub, a transition hub. So we see ourselves trying to work with and coordinate and, you know, help any group that is interested in working with us to make the big picture available. You know, there's so many different groups working, and it's sort of like one hand doesn't know what the other one is doing. But there's so much going on out there related to the resilience, to sustainability, and, you know, trying to get us through this, what you might think of as an ecological bottleneck. There's a term, ecological footprint, and that means it refers to the amount that we are consuming from the earth is more than the Earth can regenerate by itself in a year. So we're, you know, the primary production of the Earth includes all the vegetation, includes the hydrologic resources, the water that we take from aquifers, which you can think of as fossil water. Aquifers are, this is water that's been down there for thousands of years that is not easily recharged, and we're using that for irrigation. So that's, you know,
to grow food for animals.
To grow large tracts of food in areas that don't get enough rain, typically, mm-hmm. or it's spotty, mm-hmm. or, you know, seasonal. So you know, all of these things link into a knot that is going to be difficult to undo and to figure out. But this, it's estimated that the world's ecological footprint right now is 1.4. Meaning it takes about 40% more than the Earth can produce to replace what we use every year globally. If we all lived in a lifestyle similar to what we have in the United States, it might take 4 or 5 or 6 Earths to replace what we would use in a year. So that implies that our lifestyle is not sustainable in the big picture.
There are people out there listening right now, I imagine, that are saying, are you kidding me? You think that our society is going to turn around and stop being the consumer-driven, more, 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 better food, better everything place to be in the United States?
I would say I agree it's not going to turn around on a dime. Mm-hmm. But we can either start to recognize these issues and start to deal with them in a rational, cooperative way, which is what these sustainability groups and transition tries to do. It's all about improving neighbors and improving your relationships with your neighbors. It's about building community, a sense of community, desire to help people in your community. It's not going to turn around on a dime, but we can either face it now or we'll let nature, you know, nature bats last.
Nature and our children.
Yeah.
Who's ever left?
Well, these, you know, our overconsumption will come to an end. We can either choose to do it or it will be imposed by limitations of natural resources. People like to think of natural resources being infinite, but they aren't.
614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment. Jonathan, you're on the air. I probably have a question for Dr. Williams, right?
I'm not sure. Let's just see.
Okay.
I used to live in Philadelphia, which is a much larger city, and they have a downtown farmers market there called Reading Terminal, mm-hmm. which was developed from an old warehouse probably, and it's fed by the Amish. And every single day throughout the year, the Amish bring food in, and there's constant fresh food downtown. Now, they've built up those processes over the years. I'm wondering whether there's a location that's possible for Columbus. But actually, that's not my main question. Mm-hmm. My main question is, in Philadelphia, they also have fruits and vegetable stalls on many of the corners of downtown run by various private individuals. And I'm wondering why that doesn't occur here. Is it because there isn't a critical mass of enough people to buy these fruits and vegetables from the stalls, or does the city not like sidewalk vending? Or because these people were very successful, the fruit and vegetable stall runners, and you could just walk by on your way home from work or, you know, wherever you were headed and just pick up a couple fruits and vegetables and you're on your way. It was easier than going to a supermarket.
Oh, I know where I can get a sausage right now, right down on, Broad and High, but Dr. Williams.
A sausage. You know where you can get 2 oranges, an apple.
Exactly.
And
you're right.
Well, Jonathan, you gave an excellent example. Philadelphia has made some remarkable steps in the right direction, and we've actually looked at some of the programs they've done and thought of how we could model that here in our community. So we have looked into that. We continue to look into that, and we continue to see how we could do a Philadelphia-like program, and there's many other aspects of what Philadelphia does to provide access to all foods, not just fresh fruits and vegetables, to their communities, particularly in the inner city, that we would hope to model one day. So it's not that we haven't looked into it. It's not that it couldn't happen here. It just takes time. And not only does it take time, but we also have to have the appropriate vendors or farmers who have the supplies to do it. I mean, you know, you talked about supply and demand. I mean, if you think of a Howard Yoder, he is much more likely to go to a farmer's market that lasts 3 or 4 hours and has a consistent schedule every week and sell his produce than someone may. And I'm not saying that's not possible by sitting at a corner, because you don't know how much activity you're going to get. So it's not that we haven't looked into it. We continue to look at different models across the nation and see how we can implement some of those programs into our community right here. So thanks for that reminder.
I think that's a great idea. I have a follow-up comment then.
Okay.
The Reading Terminal was clearly developed over a long, long period of time, those processes, and to get those people to bring the food in. So I think that would take a very long project. But the sidewalk stalls, it seems like there was some significant encouragement, and most of the people running the stalls were Asians, new immigrants, people who just moved in, and they were selling fruits and vegetables on literally every corner. I think that is a much quicker process. You could just encourage the city to encourage sidewalk stall fruit vendors in some way. I think that would be much more likely to occur in some sort of quick time span. And I guess I'm done.
Hey, I'm game. Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Yeah, I always, when everyone was always debating about what to do with the city center, I'm like, turn it into a big grocery store, because I hate having to get in the car, drive home, and then go to a grocery store, and then go home after that. 614-292-8513. Wilson, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I was just speaking to someone, and I was telling that I have had an experience with the Army since the year 2000. I had my kitchen cabinets made during Hurricane Katrina. I'm up in Belleville, and I've been getting produce from the Amish for about going on 10 years now. And I go up in Belleville about 2 or 3 times a month. And here last week, they allowed me to actually go out in the field and pick as many tomatoes and things like that. And they will also let me go out and get the bell peppers and things like that, because the produce that they don't feel may be, some of the products they feel like they might not be able to sell and actually take to the store when they take them to the auction.
Mm-hmm.
So, but from actually dealing with me, they allow me to just go out in the field and just clean out the fields and stuff like that. And I was thinking that it would be a good thing not only to actually have the young kids take buses and things like that and go up into the Army's country, go out into the fields and see just how the fruits and vegetables happen to be raised. Plus, they can also see the young Amish kids anywhere from 2 to 3 years old. They be pushing lawnmowers. They be working together. They be grabbing the end of a rope, and they are constantly, you know, working together and everything. So that's my experience. But I noticed that they don't grow greens, they don't have collards,
mm-hmm.
mustard, or else kale. And I think I heard you speaking to a gentleman by the name of Howard Yoder.
Yes.
And I was wondering what is the reason for them not growing those particular crops?
Well, that's a very good question, and Howard's gone now, but I wonder if there is, you know, with the advent of all these farmers markets, if they're changing what they offer. And Mac, you wanted to say something?
Well, we belong to a community supported agriculture. So every week we go up to Worthington to pick up our supplies, and it includes
your subscriber.
Yeah, we're a subscriber. Yeah. So you pay something. We actually split with another person because we couldn't eat all of it between the two of us, my wife and myself. But it includes greens, many different kinds of greens, and okra, and a lot of different things. So,
so
there's a lot of variety in the CSAs.
Yeah.
Oh, you say okra?
Okra, yeah.
Okay. Now, you said up in Worthington?
It's where we pick it up. It's the – can we mention
yeah, sure.
a vendor? It's the Sipple family farm, but they also come down to the Clintonville farmers market every Saturday.
There are lots of subscription farms now. Is there some place people can go to learn more about those, Mac? I know that there's got to be – I bet you Local Matters. We're going to have them on in the next hour, Local Matters. Wilson, if you can just get online and find Local Matters website, I'm Prickly Positive. They give a list of pick your owns and places and subscription farms that you can work with to get thing. Now the I wouldn't call it a downside, but you really do have to learn how to cook the food because you get vast amounts or at least split with other people.
And get creative and learn how to pickle, learn how to can. Mm-hmm. My wife just made some salsa last night. It's really good.
Okay, we're on our way. Wilson, is that it?
No, I'm right down from the Parsons Health Department right at Miller and Livingston, and I had bought myself an Amish-made shed that looks like an Abraham Lincoln log cabin.
Uh-huh.
As I was saying, that is basically it here. But but they also have corn and stuff like that.
Sure.
Where you can just go right straight to the farm, and they have some of the biggest onions and stuff like that.
Get down there right now because they have the farmer's market going on right down on Parsons Avenue at the health department right now, okay? We have to go. We have to take off now, Wilson. We're running out of time.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thank you.
We have run out of time. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Mashika Lamail-Williams of the Columbus Public Health Department. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Nancy Hood of the OSU College of Public Health. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And finally, Matt Crawford is also of the OSU College of Public Health. I'm glad you could join us today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Appreciate all those perspectives. And I appreciate you listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.